Thank you, Prabhupada. Brothers in the Dharma. Yesterday we looked at the Buddha as the original Mahasiddha, the Adi Mahasiddha. Not a traditional term, but one I think we can use. And today I want to continue really with that theme. You probably all know that after the Buddha had seen the potential, the unlimited potential in all beings, he was moved by great compassion, great love and compassion, great sympathy and empathy. He was so moved that he left the forest and wandered the world. And first of all, he went to his old ascetic friends, the five ascetics who he'd been practicing with before he gained enlightenment, who left him because they thought he'd returned to the luxurious life because he'd taken a little bowl of milk rice and given up his fearful ascetic practices. They were staying at the deer park at Sarnath, over near Varanasi, quite a distance away from Gaya. And the Buddha thought that he'd go and see them, that they had been helpful to him, they had been friends, maybe they would understand the Dharma that he'd discovered. And he communicated with them, he got through to them. Probably they had a kind of retreat together, that's the impression you get from some of the texts. And the Buddha really got through. Eventually all of them saw what he had seen. They entered the stream which just led downward, as it were, to enlightenment. And eventually they all became his first arahant, his first enlightened disciples. So they stayed together in the deer park, in retreat, just, I suppose, enjoying their enlightenment. And in nearby the great city of Varanasi, there lived at this time a very wealthy merchant. He was one of the wealthiest men of his time in that great city. And he had an only son named Yasha. And Yasha was very handsome, and his father gave him everything. So he was very wealthy, very handsome, and I guess he's in his early 20s, something like that. And really, he just lived the life of a playboy in the mansion. There you are, there's the playboy. He had the best dress, the best fashions of the time. He lived on the finest foods. And at night, he enjoyed cultural activities. In his special room, he surrounded himself with musicians, and the text puts it, with not a man among them. So these beautiful women musicians would entertain him long into the night, and no doubt other things went on as well. And one night, after a particularly enjoyable session, he fell into a deep sleep. And then suddenly, in the middle of the night, he just woke up. It was dark. There were just a few oil lamps flickering, making weird shadows around the chamber. And then he looked around the room at the women sleeping. One was snoring. One was making sort of sucking noises. And another was muttering in her sleep. And they were kind of sprawled in a really ungainly fashion over their instruments and over the cushions. And suddenly Yasha felt utterly disgusted with himself. A great horror came over him, a great dread. And he just blurted out, "This is horrible. I'm living in the house of the dead. This is horrible. It's horrible." And he didn't really know what to do. He just had to get out of that place. He felt claustrophobic, hemmed in. So he just jumped up, thrust on a pair of golden slippers, and just ran out into the night. Just crying out as he ran out into the darkness and through the streets of Varanasi, "It's horrible. It's horrible." And he just ran and ran out of the city and into the countryside, kicking off his golden slippers. And he ran on into the trees, all the time shouting, "It's horrible! It's horrible!" He felt sick at heart. He felt disgusted, and he just shouted, "It's horrible! It's horrible!" And then suddenly, out of the darkness, a voice said, "This is not horrible. This is not horrible." And he immediately felt calm. And he stopped. His heart began to slow. He began to catch his breath. And he saw sitting among the trees, near to him, a wanderer in his rough yellow robe. He saw, in other words, the Buddha. He was just sitting out, meditating in the night. And there he was. And the Buddha just said, why don't you sit down? Let's talk about it. And so they began to talk in the beautiful, warm Indian night. Yasha, of course, explaining his situation. And the Buddha just tuned into him. And their conversation went very deep, very quickly. Yasha was just very open, very receptive. And the Buddha saw that. And so deep, so profound was their meeting that Yasha saw something. He had a glimpse of things as they really are. He entered the stream of the Dharma. Now, while all this was going on, back at home, Yasha's mother, as mothers often do, woke up in the night sensing that something wasn't right. Something was wrong. And she woke up her husband, said, "Something's not right. Something's wrong with our son. Go and see." So the father, as fathers often do, had to rouse himself, had no choice, and he went off to his son's rooms to see what was going on. No Yasha. His wife's intuition was right. He searched the house, searched the palace. No Yasha. And of course the whole household by this time is up and about. Everybody's very worried. So there's nothing for it. The father has to go off and find his son. So off he goes, and it leads him into the countryside, his search. And by some trees, he sees his son's favourite golden slippers lying there. And he just felt sick. Something must have happened to his son. Maybe he's been attacked by robbers and beaten up. Maybe he's been attacked by wild animals. Anything could have happened. And he walked on into the trees, really very worried, sweating and panting. Now the Buddha, having a very broad Mahasiddha-like awareness, could sense Yasha's father coming nearer while he was speaking to Yasha. The Buddha has panoramic awareness. It's a phrase of Chogyam Trungpa's, a very good one, panoramic awareness. He also knew directly that if Yasha saw his father, his spiritual progress would be slowed down. So by some sort of magic, he made Yasha simply disappear. It was as if he kind of created a sort of protected mandala for Yasha in which he could practice undisturbed. The Buddha really was a perfected sorcerer. So the Buddha sat as if he was on his own, and along came Yasha's father. And he told the Buddha that he was looking for his son. My son's left home. I found his slippers. We're all very worried. Have you seen him? And the Buddha, you know, tuned in to the father, and he said, "Why don't you sit down for a bit? Maybe he'll turn up." And Yasha's father admitted he was a bit tired, so he sat down and he began to talk to the Buddha. And no doubt, you know, they talked about what it was like being a father and having sons, and you know how difficult that they could be, and they were always going off. And the Buddha would have been very, very sympathetic. And their conversation went very deep, very quickly. So deep did it go that Yasha's father had a glimpse of things as they are. He too entered the stream. This was such a profound turning point for him. He was so moved, so affected. He declared on the spot that the Buddha was his teacher and refuge, and that he would follow his teaching and participate in his community so long as his life lasted. At which point, Yasha suddenly appeared. While the Buddha and Yasha's father had been speaking, Yasha had gone further and further into the stream of the Dharma in that kind of protective mandala. In fact, he'd gone so far into that stream of the Dharma, he'd entered the ocean of the Dharma itself. He'd become enlightened. And now, here he was. And Yasha's father was delighted. He was just so pleased to see his son, so he said, "Son, come home now." Anyasha said, "I can't come, Father. It's impossible for me to come back. I want to be a wanderer. I want to be like this man." But Yasha's father, though a stream entrant, said, "Come, son, you must come, because your mother is dying with grief. Give life to your mother. Come home." And then the Buddha intervened. He said to Yasha's father, "Look, you know the experience that you've had, you know the insight that you've had. Supposing you took that even further, so supposing you developed that and developed that and developed that, which Yasha has done, do you think you could live at home?" And he said, "Well, no, I don't think I could, actually. I don't think I could do that." So in that case, Yasha's father accepted what was going on, accepted the situation. He said, "Well, come tomorrow, both of you, to have lunch. I'll give you your midday meal." So Yasha's father left the park. Of course, he's going to have to explain all this to his wife and to the household, but he must have felt wonderful. He'd not just found and lost a son, he'd also attained stream entry. Fantastic night. After Yasha's father had gone, Yasha asked the Buddha if he could become part of his wandering community, a very small community. There were just six of them, the Buddha and the five ascetics. He wanted to be a sharer in alms food, a bhikkhu. So Yasha asked him, "Please, can I be a wandering disciple?" And the Buddha simply said, "Ehi bhikkhave," which means, "Come, bhikkhu." Just named him as a bhikkhu. There was no ceremony, no elaborate robes to take, nothing like that in those days. He just joined the Buddha. Probably the next day, Yasha would have discoloured his dress, ripped his ordinary dress up a bit, and turned his dress into that of a wanderer. The next day, the Buddha and Yasha went to Yasha's home for food. There must have been a lot of explaining going on the night before, because they were welcomed very happily. And after eating, the Buddha talked to the family. And of course, his talk went very deep, and Yasha's mother and Yasha's sisters entered the stream as a result of that communication. So there's a lot of spiritual activity going on in that 24 hours. And over the next few days, the word started to get around about Yasha among his wealthy friends and their families. "Yasha's gone forth. He's become a wanderer. He's found this great teacher." And people were interested. They came along to the Buddha, and before very long, more and more enlightened disciples were emerging. More and more of the younger men were going forth, were becoming wanderers. And more family people were becoming lay disciples of the Buddha, forming their own particular community as well. Eventually, there were 60 arhat disciples of the Buddha, wandering disciples of the Buddha. And when this great gathering of the Buddha called them all together into a great gathering, and he said, "Bhikkhus, I'm free of all fetters, be they gross or subtle. You too are free of all fetters, be they gross or subtle. Go now and teach the Dharma out of compassion for the welfare and happiness of the many. Let not two of you follow the same path." So he sent them on their way to wander the paths of India to teach the Dharma. And he said of himself that he was going to Gaya, going back to Gaya, where he was going to get to grips with the fire-worshipping Kashyapa brothers. But that's another story. Now, I've told this story, first of all, because it's a good story, and that's reason enough. But there is a bit more to it than that. Once again, it brings out the Buddha as Mahasiddha, as someone with great magical skill, especially in communication. It brings out that ability to tune into people so directly, that those tremendous magical powers of empathy, and also, when necessary, to do something strange and unusual, making Yasha disappear. I'm not sure how literally we can take that, but at least it makes it clear that as far as the followers of the Buddha were concerned, even in the early days, he was never regarded as a rationalist, as a philosopher. He was a saint, a yogi of great power. But I've told this story for another reason, and it's to do with the opening of the story. Yasha's waking up in his luxurious room and feeling nothing but horror and disgust at what he saw, his disillusionment and dissatisfaction with his life. We're not told why. There doesn't seem to be any reason. It just happens. He just seemed there and then to kind of see through his situation, saw through his life of selfishness and indulgence, saw it and just went, just ran. He didn't know where he was going. He just knew he had to go. This is where the spiritual life begins so often, in that experience of profound dissatisfaction and disillusion, which leads to flight, whether literal flight or metaphorical flight, or both. Eventually it leads to a search for something true, something real, something with meaning. We want to leave. We want to go forth from that life of meaninglessness, even if it means leaving, giving up things that we've cherished for years and years, for our whole life even. This experience of disillusion and dissatisfaction leading to renunciation is a strong feature of many of the lives of the Mahasiddhas. This fact is often overlooked. People read the lives of the Siddhas, they read a bit of Tantra, and they like the stories that tell of their weird behaviour, their apparent drinking, their apparent dalliance with beautiful young women. They like all that. You know, you can have the spiritual life and do everything else as well. There's no conflict. And people can even think that Buddhist practice is about getting high and having fancy sex and just living a thoroughly indulgent life, which you just label Buddhism. But that's a travesty of the Siddha life. So many stories of the Siddhas begin with disillusion and dissatisfaction. Sometimes the dissatisfaction and disillusion is a result of the simple unfolding of life. And I'm going to tell you the story of Tantipa. Tantipa was a weaver, very low caste in India, so-called low caste. When I say low caste or outcast, put that in inverted commas, but we're talking about the attitudes in India. Caste doesn't really exist, but it does in some people's minds. But though he was a weaver, Tantipa worked hard. He built up a good business, had many sons, and the sons took over the business, and the sons married, and the daughters-in-law all came to live at home, as happens. When Tantipa was 89, his wife died, and Tantipa was devastated. He became increasingly old and decrepit. He missed his wife terribly. He was going a bit, to use that word, going a little bit senile even. In short, he became a kind of embarrassment to the family. They didn't like this old man being around, the sons, the daughters-in-law. They didn't like this old man who was always missing his wife, who was forgetful and miserable. And when visitors came, he was such an embarrassment, this old fool sitting in the corner. So they had a grass hut built for him in the garden. And they said, well, you just stay out there, out of the way. You can imagine all of the kind of patronising stuff that went on. A grass hut was made for him in the garden, and he was made to live there and told, you don't come to the house. We'll bring meals down to you at 3 times a day, and you just stay there. So there's poor, lonely Tantipa. And of course, he was very resentful, very, you know, angry. He'd worked hard for this family, given them everything, and they just cast him out when he was past it, and he complained and moaned a lot, very bitter. One day the great teacher, the Mahasiddha Jalandhara, was wandering through the city, wandering out of compassion, like the disciples of the Buddha, and he begged food at the house of the weavers. And he was invited in. They liked the look of this yogi, and they wanted some merit for feeding him. He had a good meal. And the family, with typical Indian hospitality, famous Indian hospitality, asked him if he'd like to stay the night, stay over. And Jalandhara said, well, I'm a yogi. I don't sleep in houses. So they said, well, you know, it's a nice warm night. We've got a lovely garden. Why not sleep in the garden? So he said, okay, I'll sleep there. So they set up a nice place for him in a little bower. And as Jalandhara was settling down, the old weaver, Tantipa, in the grass hut, could hear him. He was disturbed. What was going on? Who was in the garden? And he called out, who's there? And Jalandhara went to the hut, and he was told him that he was a wandering yogi, just passing through, and he was going to sleep in the garden. And the two of them began to have a chat. Tantipa didn't have the chance to talk to many people, so I'm going to have a chat to this yogi. And the yogi was sympathetic, so Tantipa just started to open his heart. He said, I'm these weavers' father. I used to be the master of this house and business. But now in my old age, I'm humiliated and reviled by my own sons and daughters-in-law. To prevent anybody seeing me, I'm kept hidden here in this grass hut in the garden. How hollow are life's promises. How hollow are life's promises. He felt betrayed. And of course, this happens in life, happens when you're old. It can happen to so many anyway. Old people can so easily can feel cast off, cast out. Indeed they are. They're not interesting anymore. They're an embarrassment. Jalandhara really listened to the old man, and he said, you know, this isn't personal to you. Everything we do is like a passing show. Everything we do right now is insubstantial. It all passes, you know. It's all a hollow illusion. That's the nature of life. But there is something else. There is nirvana. Do you want me to teach you how to prepare for death? And the weaver said, yeah, I'd like that. So Jalandhara obviously sensed something in the old man. So there and then, in the hut, in the garden, Jalandhara initiated Tantipa into the meditation on the tantric deity Hirvadra. He couldn't have had all the gear for some elaborate ceremony. It was a simple transmission of a particular visualization practice. Hirvadra, the embodiment of great bliss and emptiness. And he gave him precepts about how to meditate. The next day, Jalandhara had gone. He'd just disappeared. And the old man just got on with his practice. He stopped complaining to his family. In fact, he hardly left his hut at all. They hardly ever saw him. He just stayed in the hut. They took the meals down. But Tantipa was in the hut, visualising Hirvadra and his entourage of deities, and just meditating. Generating a visualisation, dissolving it into emptiness. Just day after day after day. This went on for about 12 years, magic number for the siddhas. Anyway, one day his meal was taken down to him a bit late in the day. The family had forgotten to take him the food that day. There was some sort of celebration going on. They'd sold a particularly good carpet that day. So it was late, and instead of one of the sons taking it down, it was one of the daughters-in-law. And when she took the food to the hut, she noticed something really strange, which was really scary. She looked into the hut and there was just this weird light. She couldn't even see her father-in-law. There was just this weird glow. And around the glow of light, there were 15 really beautiful maidens kind of dancing and moving. Well, she was freaked out. So she ran to her husband, who came immediately. And he just said, let's just stay away. He must have become possessed by some sort of devil. Much too frightened to go in. And the next day, the old weaver appeared from the hut, and he looked amazing. He was still an old man, but he had the luster of a 16-year-old youth. He was radiating light, and he was obviously blissful. And he spent the rest of his days benefiting others with his wonderful presence and teaching, until he passed away to the Darkanese paradise. which is a synonym for nirvana. The old man, shunned by his family, was so disillusioned with life. He really had seen the hollowness of life's promises. So he was wide open to the teacher, Jalandhara. Tantipa's pain at being old, at being shunned, and made him see how illusory life really was. So when he heard the Dharma from Jalandhara, he really made use of that teaching. And you know, Jalandhara wasn't with him for very long. Just a night, just one night, just a few hours, just teaching him a practice. That's all. This is very common in the lives of the siddhas, in the stories of the siddhas. The teacher's not around for very long, but they communicate highly effectively. It's a very potent communication. But that isn't just because they're a great guru, a great teacher, but it's because the disciple really wants the Dharma, really needs the Dharma, because they've seen through life, life's hollow promises. They've felt that there's no refuge. They've come to the realization that there's no refuge in ordinary life, no security in ordinary life. You can't make, in the end, everything all right. Things are impermanent and insubstantial. Sooner or later, life breaks down. You can't avoid that. So the disciple sees, Tantipa sees, that he has to remake, refashion, and transform himself. You can't make life conform to your wishes. It will just defy you. So you have to remake, refashion yourself through meditation. It's very interesting. Something I've experienced a lot in India. I've spent a lot of time in India, as some of you know. And some of the old people who've come to our order there have been so impressive. I think particularly of an order member named Sangha Sen, who died a few years ago. Sangha Sen, the army of the Sangha. When he came along, he was well into his 60s, and he'd had quite a life. He was a leader of the Bidi Workers Union. That's the old country cigarettes in Vidarbha, in central India. Very, you know, powerful kind of guy, really, with the local people. But he'd had a life of smoking and drinking and trades union activism, really, for the poor and the downtrodden. And he came on a retreat with us in a real state, and he connected profoundly with the Dharma. He spent most of the retreat weeping because he realized that his life, really, even though he'd actually done a lot of good, it was all really very hollow and insubstantial, and he was just really messed up through it all. He realized that he had to really connect with the Dharma, and he did very, very quickly. And he led his life, after he'd become ordained, just wandering from village to village in Vidarbha, that's central India, just talking to people about the Dharma. He'd go from place to place. He'd just go into the Buddhist part of town, or he'd go into the village square, and he'd just say, "I'm giving a meditation class tonight. I'm giving a Dharma talk tonight. Why don't you come along?" That's the way he lived. And he was blissful. He was so happy at doing that. And he really made the youngsters, including myself, really ashamed with his energy and intensity. So, you know, sometimes that life experience, just getting older, you do see through. You see through life, and you can be then wide open to the Dharma. Sometimes we come to a kind of halt in our practice. Sometimes, you know, we might have been meditating for a while, but suddenly we're unmotivated, we get stuck. We might even begin to doubt our practice, our teachers, our spiritual friends, ourselves. We come, as it were, to the end of Buddhism's entertainment value. You know, inevitably when we take up Buddhism and meditation, there's a kind of entertainment novelty value. Well, when that happens, we need then to look deeply at the roots of our motivation. What are we using Buddhism for? To help us to just manipulate the world to our advantage better? Or are we using Buddhism to reshape and refashion ourselves in tune with the impermanent, insubstantial, and unsatisfactory nature of things? Successful Buddhist practice involves facing up to what is really going on. Sooner or later, if you're serious in your Buddhist practice, you have to start engaging with the realities of life. That life is insubstantial, but it's a passing show. Try to control it, try to fix it, try to build a permanent, ultimately satisfying life in it. It just won't work. In the end, we perish and pass away, and those we love perish and pass away. In the end, we could be that shunned and reviled old man, scorned by those he'd worked for. And what are we going to do? Are we going to moan about feeling so let down and betrayed? Is that what we're going to do? Well, look, life will betray you. In one way or another, life will betray you, because you can't rely on it. It's so insubstantial, it's so impermanent. Meaning comes from living a life of individual transformation, taking yourself on, reforming yourself, becoming Hevajra, becoming the Buddha, becoming the union of bliss and emptiness. Doesn't happen overnight, of course. Tantipa practiced constantly for 12 years. 12 years of regular practice. And it was just one practice, one set of instructions. That was enough. And it worked because he wanted it. He needed it because he was tired of life strategies. Sometimes the stories of disillusionment in the lives of the siddhas come from the daily grind of existence. Many of the siddhas were from tough occupations. I mentioned the other night the blacksmith, when the yogin comes in and says, "Are you happy?" And he says, "You must be joking. You know, doing this work day in, day out, and the sparks burning my arms and legs." And out of that communication, the blacksmith took up the dharma. Or the cobbler who has to mend, you know, dirty shoes every day, who just longs for higher things, longs for a spiritual life. Or the scavenger, or the peasant farmer. Life grinds them down, but a siddha comes along and gives their life meaning. Again, this thing of the daily grind was really brought home to me when I lived in India. Some of the people involved in our Sangha really had tough jobs in factories, you know, really rough factories, living in, you know, slums in Bombay, which is a very, very tough city. And a lot of them, just took to drink. And you could understand why, just to blot out, you know, what was going on, just to blot out the daily grind. And then when they connected with the Dharma, they just immediately stopped drinking. They still had to do the jobs they did, because they had to bring home the money for the extended family. But their life had meaning. Having a regular practice of meditation, having the Dharma, life gave even meaning to that daily grind. There's a lovely kind of Mahasiddha-like story of an order member who was a drunkard, who lived in a before he was an order member, that is, living in a slum in Pune, and he was regularly, you know, out of his head on country liquor. And one day he found in his house a book, a pamphlet in Marathi on going for refuge. A translation of one of Sangharakshita's talks that he'd given in India. So while he was drunk, he read this pamphlet and had a blinding revelation which made him give up drinking and take up the Dharma and become an order member. So it happens. Sometimes the disillusion, the seeing through, comes out of loss and grief. And there's the story here of Kankaripa. Kankaripa was a poor man, but he was a happy man. And especially he was happy when his marriage was arranged with a local girl and they settled down. And he absolutely adored his wife, and she adored him. It was a really good marriage. He was an ordinary man with an ordinary wife. He worked hard, had a decent life, and they were just in bliss, marital bliss. They were very happy, very contented. Life was so very, very good. But then suddenly, we're not told why, his wife died. Just suddenly. And he had to carry her. He wouldn't let anybody else do it. He carried her himself to the cremation ground. And he was just insane with grief. And he just insisted on sitting next to the corpse of his wife in the charnel ground. Just sitting there. He wouldn't move. He just wanted to be with her. He didn't want her to go. So he's with this corpse, sitting there, beside himself with grief, paralysed with it. He couldn't move. He was in a state of utter despair at the loss of his wife. And of course, cremation grounds, charnel grounds, are places where yogins hang out. And along came a yogin. And the yogin said, "Well, what's wrong?" He said, "Well, can't you see what a state I'm in? My wife has died, and it's the end. It's the end of a glorious life for me. I feel as if my eyes have been torn out. No one on earth can suffer more than this." And he just went on and on, absolutely beside himself with grief. And the yogin was sympathetic, as Siddha yogins are. But he was also very direct, and he went straight to the point. He said, "Look, all life ends in death. Every meeting ends in parting. All compounded things eventually disintegrate. Everyone in this round of birth and death suffers. It's the nature of things. It's not personal. Don't grieve. Why guard this corpse that's no different from the earth? Why not practice the Dharma and liberate yourself from pain?" Well, the yogin was, very effective, but Kankarapa said, "Well, all right. If there's a way out of pain, show me." He was desperate, but I don't think he was entirely convinced. And the guru taught him how to meditate. He gave him a number of instructions. First of all, he taught him to meditate on a seed essence. He gave him a teaching on meditating on just a point of light, of coloured light, which symbolised pure, non-dual awareness. And the guru was highly skillful as well. He knew that Kankarapa would be completely fixated on his wife. He might try to visualise that dot, but he'd be thinking about his wife. So instead of saying, get rid of that hindrance, he didn't talk like that. He said, "See her. Let your wife be there. But visualise her, see her as a Dakini, a beautiful sky-going goddess. See her as it's insubstantial as a rainbow. See her as form and emptiness blended. See her as bliss and emptiness blended." And then the yogin went off and left Kankarapa to it. He meditated. And after 6 years of practice, he no longer grieved for his wife. In fact, all his experience, he said, was liberated into pure pleasure. Everything became the Dakini, the wisdom lady. Everything became the perfect blending of form and emptiness. Everything was liberated by itself. And this is Kankarapa's song of realization. "My Dakini woman, my queen, my lady, the visible form of my pure awareness, form not separate from me, nor yet a part of me, the phenomenal appearance of empty space. She is beyond compare and beyond words." So again, this Kankarapa is successful because he's highly motivated. He has that intense experience of dukkha and the profound dissatisfaction that goes with it. The story also tells us something of the highly skillful methods of the siddhas. The guru who taught Kankarapa didn't tell him to stop thinking about his wife. He knew that wasn't possible. His fixation, Kankarapa's fixation, was so strong, it had to be used, it had to be harnessed. There was an intense concentration upon his wife. So the guru taught him to harness that, taught him to see his wife differently, not as an ordinary woman of flesh and blood, but as the Dakini, the sky-going goddess, embodying the true nature of things, as a symbol of the illusory, playful, beautiful, ungraspable, yet bliss-bestowing reality. Sometimes, if we're very fixated on something, especially in meditation, we can use that in our practice. If there's a powerful emotional involvement in something, you can become very concentrated through it. People like this idea, of course. They like the idea especially if a beautiful person comes up in their meditation, a woman or a man. And yes, it is possible to harness that image, harness that energy. But the motivation has to be strong. There does have to be the desire to transform oneself, ultimately into the Buddha. Yes, probably we'll have a look at a bit later on more about these Dakinis, these beautiful goddesses, and more about transformation. But before we do that, I want to stay for a while longer with disillusion, with seeing through the world, with renunciation, and with the motivation for Dharma practice. Our various stories, Yasha, the young playboy, Tantipa, the old weaver, Kankarapa, the lovelorn widower, are all about people who become disillusioned with the world and who then plunge into the Dharma. But renunciation and going forth, disillusionment, can arise in relation to Buddhist practice and the Buddhist world one practices within. Just because you're a Buddhist doesn't mean that you've perfected renunciation. We can use Buddhism, we probably will use Buddhism, to settle down, to make ourselves very cozy and comfortable. And this brings us to the story of the Mahasiddha Naropa. Naropa lived in the 10th or the 11th century, and he came from a very good family indeed. His parents were minor Bengali royalty. And when he was young, he was sent to Kashmir to study the Dharma. He became a monk, became a great scholar, a great pundit. In fact, he was so great, so learned and so brilliant that he was invited to become the abbot of the greatest monastery in India, Nalanda Mahavihara. Nalanda Mahavihara was really a huge monastic city come university, with enormous lands which they owned, and all the produce they lived on and so on and so forth. Very wealthy. And Naropa was extremely learned in aspects of all aspects of Buddhist philosophy. Abhidharma, Madhyamaka, Yogacara, Buddhist logic or Nyaya. He was learned in grammar and the different arts and sciences, incredibly cultured. He even practiced tantric ceremonies within the context of his monastic life. So he was a kind of classic leading monk of his time. Highly learned, highly cultured. And he was very important to the other monks because he was tremendous in debate. Regularly defeated non-Buddhist philosophers, Hindu and Jain, in debate. Debate was a big feature of Indian Buddhism. The kings and royalty liked to see the different philosophers go head to head. All in all, life was going very well for Naropa. He had a good religious life. He was highly respected within the great monastic community and within the country at large. He was probably one of the greatest Buddhist celebrities of his day, a Buddhist celebrity. Now, one day, Naropa was sitting in a courtyard of the monastery, and a significant detail, he was sitting with his back to the sun. And he was studying the books on grammar, epistemology, spiritual precepts, and logic. Suddenly, a terrifying shadow fell across what he was studying. He looked around and he saw, to his horror, an old woman, a crone, just standing there. And she was terrible to behold. A quote from the text. Her hair was fox-coloured and dishevelled, her forehead large and protruding, Her face had many wrinkles and was shriveled up. Her ears were long and lumpy. Her nose was twisted and inflamed. She had a yellow beard streaked with white. Her mouth was distorted and gaping. Her teeth were turned in and decayed. Her tongue made chewing movements and moistened her lips. She made sucking noises and licked her lips. She whistled when she yawned. She was weeping, and tears ran down her cheeks. She was shivering and panting for breath. Her complexion was darkish blue. Her skin rough and thick. Her body bent and askew. Her neck curved. She was hump-backed, and being lame, she supported herself on a stick. And the old woman, the crone, came close to the handsome monk in his yellow robes, with his shiny, shaven head, anointed with perfumed oils. "What are you looking into?" she said. "I study the books on grammar, epistemology, spiritual precepts and logic," replied Naropa. "Do you understand them?" "Yes," came the reply. "Do you understand the words or the meaning?"
"The words." And at that, the old woman was delighted. I mean, she was crazy. She rocked with laughter. She just thought this was really funny. And she was very, very pleased, really, really pleased with what Naropa had to say. And Naropa, thinking, well, let's humour her, he thought he'd please her some more. And he said, "I also understand the meaning." And then the old crone was just not pleased at all. She threw down her stick and she began to weep and tremble. She was really very, very distressed and upset. And Naropa was very puzzled. I mean, just imagine it. You're sitting there and in comes this old woman asking you these questions, one minute laughing and the next minute really upset. So Naropa says, "How is it that you were happy when I said I understood the words, but became miserable when I said that I understood the meaning?" And the old woman replied, "I felt happy because you, a great scholar, did not lie, and frankly admitted that you only understood the words. But I felt sad when you told a lie by stating that you understood the meaning, which you do not." Naropa was very disturbed. Something really got to him, and he just blurted out, "Well, who does understand the meaning?" And the old woman said, "My brother understands the meaning." "Well, where is he?" said Naropa. "Go yourself and pay your respects to him, and beg him that you may come to grasp the meaning." And with these words, the old woman vanished like a rainbow, vanishing into space. One moment she was there, the next she had gone. And of course, this left Naropa completely stunned. It plunged him, in fact, into profound contemplation and meditation. But before we find out about his meditation and its fruits, let's just pause and reflect on Naropa's encounter with the old crone. It's one of the great encounters in Buddhist literature, and I think the old woman is one of the great characters of Buddhist literature. The old woman represents so much that a famous, high-caste, young, brilliant Indian Buddhist monk, celebrity, scholar, pandit would rather not know about. She's a woman, for a start, who somehow has entered the great monastery. Right to its heart she's penetrated, right into the abbot's quarters. And of course, Naropa's a celibate monk. And she's old. And she's obviously someone despised and dark-skinned, obviously poor, low-caste, even outcast. Just a simple old woman. Dirty, untidy, dark, messy, old, diseased. The polar opposite to the celibate Naropa, with his books that impose order and structure on the universe, in his great, well-ordered, highly organized monastic institution with its ritual, ceremony and observance. The monastery being, of course, part of the whole conventional Indian scene. Whereas this old outcast woman is completely natural. She doesn't care what people think about her. She's completely unself-conscious. She doesn't worry. She's completely direct. The crone also brings the chaos of old age, disease and death, brings the facts of the world into the heart of Naropa's well-ordered Buddhist world. Naropa, although a Buddhist monk, had forgotten what Buddhism was for. Buddhism, Indian Buddhism of that time, with its philosophy, its highly elaborate philosophy and dialectic and argument, and its monastic observance, had become a massive distraction. He knew the words, but he did not know the sense. He did not know the meaning. The crone brings the meaning, brings the sense of the Dharma in its most terrifying form right into the heart of Naropa. She brings the truth of old age, disease and death, brings it as a reality, brings it in her being. And she brings as well insubstantiality and ungraspability as well. She must have been totally baffling to Naropa. There he was with all his, he's probably very handsome, probably a very beautiful cultural, philosophical scene as he sits there. And in comes this thing which is just totally weird and irrational. And she shows herself, she speaks, and then she just vanishes and disappears. Was it a dream? Was it a vision? What happened? The texts explain that she was none other than the great Dakini embodiment of the Buddha's wisdom and compassion, Vajrayogini. This is a highly significant detail. So she was a Dakini. It's a significant detail because people, when they hear this word Dakini, think of them as sexy young women who you can have a sort of amorous pseudo-spiritual scene with, but not so fast. Sometimes, in fact frequently, the Dakini doesn't show herself as young and beautiful and groovy at all. More often than not, she appears as an ugly, rough old woman, a crone, a witch, a simple woman, telling it, showing it exactly as it is, challenging your complacency. I remember once when I was in India giving a talk in a railway town. You get these towns in India which have just sort of sprung up by a railway junction, and this was a town named Manmad, which is a very rough town, but a lot of Buddhists there. And I gave a lecture one night in this town, and it was the first one of a tour I was doing in that area, and it was a very inspiring occasion. There were a few thousand people there, and they made me very welcome, and they gave me, you know, I was kind of almost buried under garlands, and, you know, if I say to them myself, I gave a great talk, and people really enjoyed it, and there was a lovely atmosphere, etc., etc. And the next day, in our, well, we hardly call it a hotel, but the boarding house we were staying in, I was sitting in the room with my interpreter, and we were feeling pretty pleased with ourselves, you know, it'd all gone well, and other Buddhists were coming in and saying how pleased they were. And then an old woman came in a simple cotton sari to sweep the room. She was the cleaner in the house, and she was sweeping the room, and she was gabbling away in Marathi, in her rough village Marathi, talking away, and she was weeping. And the interpreter just was telling her she was obviously firing stuff at him, and he was saying, be quiet. And I said, come on, tell me what she's saying. Tell me what she's saying to us. So we had a chat through the interpreter, and she said, I'm so upset. Yes, it was a good talk last night, but you know, I'm so upset because I'm a Buddhist. I was there at your talk. And I'm so upset because the followers of Dr. Ambedkar, the Buddhist people, just argue a lot. There's too much disharmony in our Sangha and our movement. people need to really practice the Dharma. And she went on and on and on. And it was really, really a very, very powerful communication. Just showing us both that there was so much work to do, so much work to bring harmony into this situation. We were feeling really pleased with ourselves for our great talk. She was showing us where the work really needed to happen was. It's just a simple, illiterate woman who swept that place. I mentioned it to some friends, some older member friends of mine afterwards. You know, what an amazing encounter it was, and, you know, memorable encounter. And one of them told me, he said, God, that's really weird. I stayed in that place and I met an old woman sweeping, and she gave me a lecture about the Dharma as well. Maybe she's still there. Maybe. Let's go back to Naropa. The vision of the old woman prompted in Naropa a profound meditation on the unsatisfactoriness of life. He looked right into the unsatisfactoriness of life, and right into himself as well. He developed penetrating insight into his own impermanence and insubstantiality. And more than that, he saw that his being, though impermanent and insubstantial, because of that, it was pure potentiality, pure energy, if you like, capable of total transformation. He had a glimpse, the text tells us, of sahaja, the natural, spontaneous nature of things, the real state of things. He saw that reality is there, present in every moment, precisely because it's impermanent and insubstantial. Because of that, reality is there, blissful, empty, luminous. And his meditation was so profound, he knew that he had to leave the great monastic city of Nalanda. He had to give up being the great Buddhist celebrity, the abbot of the great monastery, renounce all the prestige, all the security, renounce position and power, renounce his colleagues, renounce his disciples. He knew that he had to find the brother of the old woman, the man who knew the sense, the meaning of the words. That's another story. But I'm going to end with Naropa's song of realization, the song he sang after his profound meditation. Samsara is the tendency to find fault with others, an unbearable fireball, a dark dungeon. A deep swamp of the three poisons, greed, hatred, delusion. A fearful wave of evil lives. It's like being caught in a spider's web, or a bird tangled in a fowler's net. It's like being bound hand to neck by Mara, or immersed in a pond of beastliness. It's like a deer chasing a mirage. It is the net of karma. It is like a bee stuck in nectar, milking the cow of life and living beneath the fleeting shadows of old age and death. It's like being caught by the Lord of Death's rough-coated dogs, a deer trapped in a snare, a merciless hunter, entanglement in bondage, an unsafe footpath, a wild beast trapped in a pit. It is a meadow full of grasping and obsession. It is a horse of the eight worldly winds, a spearhead beating on a drum, its merriment with sharpened fangs. It is like a fragile water plant, the intangible reflection of the moon in water, a bubble of bewilderment, fleeting mist and rippling water, a snake conquering by touch and sight. It's the taste of honey on a razor blade. It is a tree with poisonous leaves, shooting the poisoned arrow of the defilements and poisoning those afflicted by defects. It is a flame flickering in the wind, untruth, a dream, bewilderment, the waterfall of old age and death. It is Klesha Mara, the deceiving guide. Truly, I must search for the Guru.